In a world where we're constantly bombarded with filtered images of perfection, Melissa Broder's So Sad Today arrives like a refreshing slap of reality. Originally known for her anonymous Twitter account of the same name that amassed hundreds of thousands of followers, Broder's collection of essays pulls back the curtain on mental illness with unflinching honesty. This book has become something of a cult classic among millennials and Gen Z readers seeking raw authenticity about anxiety, depression, and existential dread. Celebrities like Lena Dunham and Katy Perry have praised its brutal honesty, with Dunham calling it a desperately needed voice. What makes this work particularly significant is how it arrived at the perfect cultural moment, when social media was creating unprecedented pressure for perfection while simultaneously providing platforms to discuss mental health more openly than ever before. Broder doesn't just confess her darkest thoughts, she transforms them into art that makes readers feel less alone in their own struggles. The journey into inadequacy begins at birth, or perhaps even before. Broder describes the womb as nirvana, a warm, wet rave where you're the only raver, explaining why she was reluctant to leave it, arriving 2 weeks late. This metaphor perfectly captures the first transition from complete sufficiency to perpetual lack, from a state of perfect contentment to one of constant wanting. From her very first day, she learned the lesson of not being enough when she couldn't accept a doctor's compliment about being pretty. This established a pattern where positive things felt like mistakes, while negative things became truth, a cognitive distortion that would shape her entire worldview. She decided she must stay pretty forever, or it would be her fault, creating an impossible standard from infancy that would haunt her relationships with both herself and others. Among other babies, she felt inadequate, already wrestling with existential concerns far beyond her years, obsessing about death while simultaneously unable to accept her mortality. This early preoccupation with existence and non-existence would later manifest in her adult struggles with anxiety and depression. When her mother complained that she was killing her by sucking too hard while breastfeeding, it became concrete proof of her inherent too muchness, establishing the impossible paradox of being simultaneously not enough and too much that would follow her throughout life. This early experience created a deep-seated belief that her very needs were somehow harmful to those she loved most. Seeking comfort in a world that felt increasingly hostile to her existence, she longed for a cosmic titty, a metaphysical source of unlimited nurturing and acceptance to fill her existential holes, but ended up with just a bottle. This material substitute for spiritual fulfillment became a pattern that would repeat throughout her life in various forms of addiction and seeking. In response, she began consuming parts of herself, fingernails, toenails, boogers, creating brief moments of self-contained bliss. These small acts of self-cannibalism provided rare comfort in a world that felt fundamentally uncomfortable, establishing a pattern of seeking solace through self-destructive behaviors that would evolve as she grew older. This origin story of inadequacy sets the foundation for understanding Broder's relationship with herself and others, illuminating how early experiences shape our fundamental beliefs about ourselves. The feeling of fundamental wrongness, of being either too much or not enough, becomes the lens through which she experiences everything from relationships to career choices to her own body. It manifests in her adult life through perfectionism, people-pleasing, and a constant search for external validation. It's a universal human struggle magnified through her particularly sensitive nervous system, making her experiences both uniquely personal and broadly relatable to anyone who has ever felt like an outsider in their own life. After college, Broder fled the East Coast to escape a tumultuous relationship that had left her emotionally depleted, landing at a tantric sex nonprofit called Electric Yoni in Marin County, California. Fresh off 4 years of experimental psychedelics and deeply immersed in New Age spirituality, she desperately believed external solutions could rescue her from her internal struggles. Each day, she made the scenic but emotionally charged commute from her cramped apartment in San Francisco's gritty Lower Tenderloin district over the majestic Golden Gate Bridge, feeling simultaneously blessed and miserable, a profound contradiction that would become a recurring theme throughout her life's journey. Her employer, Judy Moon, born Elizabeth Hartley, a shipping heiress who'd renamed herself in pursuit of spiritual authenticity, ran Electric Yoni from her entirely pink-decorated Belvedere mansion, a symbol of wealthy spiritual excess. The operation continued until the affluent neighbors finally succeeded in their complaints about the constant parade of Priuses and participants dressed in flowing Renaissance fair costumes disrupting their exclusive community. Despite the organization's emphasis on nonviolent communication and emotional awareness, Judy's management style was notably aggressive and manipulative. She regularly cornered Broder in hallways, hissing that Broder's very presence and work style triggered deep insecurities in her. At 21, attractive and struggling with both addiction and severe boundary issues, Broder found herself sampling the organization's curriculum with naive curiosity. This included an uncomfortable experience with a vaginal massage from a 50-something self-proclaimed healer in a do-rag who offered 3 hours of yoni healing in exchange for writing promotional materials. Her vulnerability during this period extended to convincing her skeptical lesbian friend to try the same treatment, a decision her friend later deeply regretted, stating plainly, "I can't believe I let that man touch my vagina in the name of healing." Through her work at Electric Yoni, she encountered Mamadou, a charismatic man who initially seemed to offer genuine spiritual connection, engaging her in deep discussions about Sufi poets Rumi and Hafiz. Their relationship took an unexpected turn when he offered her $700 for what she believed would be spiritual companionship and drug sharing, only to reveal romantic intentions. When he attempted to kiss her, she left with the money, but was forced to confront an uncomfortable truth about herself, reflecting that she'd rather believe someone would pay for my personality than my body, despite having slept with countless unattractive men for free when blackout drunk and lonely. These formative experiences crystallized Broder's complex relationship with spirituality and sexuality, both domains where she desperately sought authentic connection and transcendence, but frequently encountered manipulation and exploitation instead. Her genuine search for meaning through spiritual practices remained sincere, even as she developed a sharp awareness of the wellness industry's contradictions and commercial absurdities. This fundamental tension between cynical awareness and authentic spiritual seeking became a defining characteristic of her approach to life's deeper questions, informing both her personal journey and later written work. The period at Electric Yoni served as a crucial lesson in the ways spiritual seeking can both illuminate and obscure one's path to self-discovery. "I am an eater who refuses to be the kind of woman who lets herself go," Broder confesses, revealing the war between her appetite and her desire to remain thin. After marrying at 29 and gaining weight, she panicked about becoming amorphous, losing her independence and sexual appeal, as if the weight symbolized the blurring of her identity. She turned to Weight Watchers, which transformed food into numbers, perfect for her obsessive tendencies, but terrible for someone with lifelong eating disorders. Eventually, she returned to just counting calories, algebra instead of calculus, but still a world of numbers. With brutal honesty, she acknowledges being a horrible feminist who dreams of what she would eat if she identified as a man. So much pizza, non-diet Mountain Dew, yet she's also a good feminist in her honesty about not having dismantled these warped schemas about women's bodies. Hypocritically, she lusts after zaftic female bodies while denying herself that freedom. Her typical porn search is fat lesbians, the fantasy of being accepted at your biggest self, gorging together without limits before devouring each other, a freedom she cannot allow herself. She compares her body to other women's, occasionally winning by being skinnier, closer to magazine standards, terrified of reproach, though she's not sure from whom. She feels safest being very thin, far from fat, which represents shame and self-hatred. Sometimes she still longs for the full binge, that beautiful return to self where she enters a silence before words, but the critical voices always return. This section illuminates how deeply cultural messaging about women's bodies has penetrated broader psyche, creating a constant state of self-surveillance and restriction. The conflict between her intellectual understanding that these standards are harmful and her emotional inability to free herself from them creates a painful dissonance that many readers, particularly women, will recognize. Her honesty about this struggle, admitting her contradictions without excusing them, is part of what makes her voice so compelling.
"My sexual preference is escaping myself," Broder admits, revealing how she's used relationships to either validate her okayness or simply disappear. What she's sought in love is relief from consciousness, transcendence from human imperfection, but instead created fictional love stories filtered through her insecurities. This pattern reached its apex in an intense sexting relationship that escalated into elaborate fantasies, mixing explicit sexual acts with social media interactions. They'd craft detailed scenarios about intimate encounters in unusual places, often incorporating absurd elements like Twitter interactions during sex. Beyond the sexual content, they texted about depression, anxiety, therapy, childhood pain, and existential voids, creating an intense emotional bond. When they finally met at a Manhattan hotel, reality couldn't match their digital chemistry. Though she found him attractive, their physical connection felt forced and awkward. He couldn't maintain an erection, and she faked enthusiasm. They both sensed a shared sadness beneath their attempts at connection. The next morning brought a more natural intimacy, but the gap between virtual and physical reality remained. Eventually, she confessed her growing feelings, wondering if they could be together despite her marriage, their age difference, and geographic separation. This relationship exemplifies Broder's pattern of seeking transcendence through connection, using another person to escape her own consciousness, while simultaneously recognizing the impossibility of truly merging with another human being. The internet serves as both salvation and prison in Broder's life. It offers connection and escape while increasing her isolation and solipsism. She prefers the internet's illusions, where she can present a curated version of herself, to the complexities of reality and flesh. She experiences withdrawal symptoms when disconnected and uses the internet to block disturbing thoughts about mortality and the unsettling hyper-reality of existence. She struggles with time management online, frequently saying, "just a few more minutes," before falling into hours-long vortexes. She wakes at 3 a.m. to go online, hides her usage habits, and prefers virtual socializing where she can be a fucking wizard instead of her mundane reality. The internet holds infinite potential compared to life's repetitive patterns, making it the perfect addiction for someone seeking escape from the limitations of human existence.
"I experience constant judgment from the natural world. The ocean, moon, dogs, and babies all seem to see through me," Broder writes, describing the sensation of being perpetually evaluated. Despite reassurances that she's no better or worse than others, she prefers believing a cosmic arbiter judges her as uniquely awful rather than feeling insignificant. To manipulate this judge, she plays games elevating superficial concerns to life or death importance, particularly with calories. By obsessing over the exact caloric content of fruits and vegetables, she channels existential dread into manageable anxiety. She knows precisely that a large apple is 100 calories and a sweet potato 165, yet deliberately buys oversized produce while maintaining these counts, then worries about getting fat. The committee in her head constantly criticizes these preoccupations as privileged and selfish when bigger issues exist. This committee, the critical voices in her mind, serves as both tormentor and familiar companion. Its constant chatter provides a perverse comfort. At least when she's being criticized, she matters enough to be criticized. The alternative, cosmic insignificance, feels even more terrifying than judgment. For Broder, Dodd exists in a profound internal silence that persists beneath the committee's noise. When she meditates each morning for 10 minutes before going online, she spends the first 8 minutes being berated by the committee before briefly accessing the silence.
This practice doesn't make her enlightened, but it reduces her impulsiveness from 96% to 92%. That crucial 4% keeps her alive by providing a reference point that the committee's voices aren't the complete truth. This section brilliantly captures the experience of living with anxiety and self-criticism. The metaphor of the committee gives form to the often formless experience of negative self-talk, while her description of finding moments of silence beneath the noise offers hope without oversimplifying the struggle. Her ability to find humor in these painful experiences, like precisely counting calories and oversized produce, demonstrates how comedy can be both a coping mechanism and a path to insight. Broder's life has been shaped by various addictions, substances, relationships, the internet, and nicotine gum. She's terrified of an afterlife without nicotine gum, which she must have constantly, while kissing, sleeping, everything. The gum provides synthetic hope every 30 minutes when she unwraps a fresh piece, self-soothing when reality feels unbearable. Her smoking began at 14 with a stolen Marlboro Red from her dad, followed by romantic Marlboro Lights with boyfriends. Cigarettes quickly became meal replacements when paired with Diet Coke and gum, escalating to 2 packs daily. She discovered nicotine gum before a London flight at age 20, revealing a glorious new addiction chapter, one with perfect access and secrecy. The gum became her constant companion, creating a barrier between her and true intimacy. She recognizes it reflects her inability to be present, but the dilution of her aliveness seems worth it for something that gives her control and structure. "I just want to be okay," she admits, "and I don't trust myself or the universe to find that okayness alone." Beyond nicotine, Broder developed an unusual sexual fetish at a young age, an attraction to vomiting. Not the substance, but the primal, involuntary act itself. It began at age 3, when her typically unnurturing mother tenderly cared for her after she vomited in her sleep. This rare experience of being loved at her most disgusting was intoxicating and created a lifelong association between vulnerability, disgust, and love. She had her first orgasm at 10 while fantasizing about a popular girl vomiting, and her fantasies evolved but maintained consistent themes. What unites them is complete acceptance and embrace of someone at their most vulnerable and disgusting. Though she's never incorporated vomiting into her actual sex life, she often secretly employs these fantasies during sex with partners to achieve orgasm, causing her to drift off during intimacy. These addictions and fixations serve as coping mechanisms, ways to manage overwhelming emotions and create a sense of control in an unpredictable world. They also reveal Broder's deep longing for unconditional acceptance and her fear that she is fundamentally unlovable in her most authentic state. The vomit fetish, in particular, symbolizes her desire to be loved not despite, but including her most disgusting, vulnerable aspects. A profound metaphor for unconditional love. "I'm trying to quit getting high on people," Broder writes, comparing her romantic obsessions to addiction. With her drug person, they had genuine love but got intoxicated on each other. Their relationship thrived on distance and unavailability, like Keats's ode on a Grecian urn, but with iPhones. When she didn't get texts, she was sick. When she received them, she was well, but only until her next message, when the waiting began again. She tried quitting multiple times, but kept returning for one more taste. Eventually, the pain outweighed the highs, and she blocked him. She grieved deeply, crying about deaths from 15 years ago. Even her dreams of him changed. She knew they weren't right for each other. Then he contacted her again through Facebook. His drunken messages from Morocco revealed his own addiction. "I love you still obsessively, and I am crying. You are the best human." She broke her silence, asking if he could love me at your front door, knowing neither of them truly could. This pattern of addiction to unavailable people reflects Broder's larger struggle with human connection. She longs for complete merging with another person, a return to the nirvana of the womb, while simultaneously fearing the loss of self such merging would entail. The result is a preference for relationships that can never be fully realized, where fantasy can flourish in the spaces between actual contact. In her marriage, this dynamic takes on additional complexity. Her husband suffers from a chronic illness, CFIDS-ME, that has progressively worsened over their relationship. After 5 years together, they opened their marriage, for him, with strict rules requiring her pre-approval, for her, with complete freedom but no disclosure to him. Initially hesitant to act on this freedom, she eventually began pursuing younger men, confident against rejection because she had a husband as a safety net. The problem was that she couldn't just have sex and move on. She caught feelings. With each lover, she felt like a teenager flitting between excitement and heartbreak. None of these threatened her marriage. If anything, they made it hotter. Open marriage reminded her that having a husband was a choice, not a possession. Only her last lover, Demetrius, threatened her marriage. For a year, they sexted and emailed across the country, meeting in New York hotel rooms. Their connection felt spiritual, making her question her marriage. These experiences revealed the fundamental impossibility of fully merging with another person. We remain separate consciousnesses, no matter how close we become. Broder's search for transcendence through relationships is ultimately doomed, yet she continues seeking connection despite knowing its limitations. This tension between the longing for complete union and the reality of permanent separation drives much of her relationship behavior and reflects a universal human dilemma.
I've always had general anxiety, followed by panic disorder, but it took years to realize depression lay underneath, Broder writes. The anxiety served as a coping mechanism. Its heightened sensations were somehow preferable to the ocean of sadness beneath. Her panic attacks come in cycles, occurring mainly around people where she fears judgment for not being okay. The night before her wedding, she had a near psychedelic attack during family dinner, finally breaking down in tears, revealing that sadness lay beneath her anxiety. During a particularly harrowing cycle of attacks, she saw a shaman who identified her condition as depression rather than anxiety. Through visualization, they removed symbolic beings blocking her emotional center. This experience gave her permission to acknowledge her depression. She began tweeting anonymously as @sosadtoday, finding relief in sharing her feelings. As the account grew popular, she realized celebrating her sensitivity connected her with others who understood. "I've spent my life damming an ocean of sadness," she writes, "but maybe that ocean itself is the ultimate rescue, a reprieve from the linear mind into the world of feeling." Her struggle with mental health reached a crisis point during withdrawal from the antidepressant Effexor. After 11 years on the medication, she attempted to transition to Prozac. Initially smooth, the withdrawal became nightmarish once she was completely off Effexor. She experienced terrifying hallucinations, existential dread, and what felt like a darkness in my soul. She documents her withdrawal day by day, from fetal position panic to feeling like she's on bad acid. Throughout, she battles the fear that these terrible feelings might be permanent, trying to remind herself she's just sick but will get better. After 15 days of hell, she decides to go back on Effexor. This section powerfully illustrates the physical reality of mental illness, how conditions like anxiety and depression manifest in bodily symptoms, and how medication withdrawal can create profound suffering. It also highlights the courage required to face these conditions directly rather than numbing them with substances or distractions. Throughout her essays, Broder returns to the fundamental human struggle to accept imperfection in ourselves, in others, and in life itself. Her shame around anxiety drives her to overcompensate and never appear vulnerable, which only fuels more anxiety. She fears showing her real suffering, terrified of dropping her funny mask and being perceived as not okay. She deflects vulnerability into humor or wise platitudes, unable to simply receive compassion because it feels like weakness. Part of her longs to surrender, to just tell people exactly what's happening when panic strikes, to prioritize her peace over others' perceptions. But would she end up jobless, friendless, loveless? Would she vanish entirely? In a conversation with her higher self, she explores her fears about embracing spiritual light. She worries about judgment, addiction, and disappearing into the infinite. Her higher self points out she's already been addicted to countless things, so maybe light addiction would be good. When she expresses terror about death and suffocation, her higher self challenges her to truly confront mortality, suggesting her obsession with trivial concerns is a distraction. The conversation reveals her fear of containing multitudes, of being both good and evil simultaneously. Her higher self reminds her that this duality is universal. Look around, Bib, that's all there is. This acceptance of contradiction and imperfection, of being simultaneously too much and not enough, of containing both light and darkness, represents the closest thing to peace Broder finds. Through sharing her most shameful thoughts and feelings, Broder creates connection with readers who recognize their own struggles and hers. "All I truly want," she writes, "is to connect with others on a deep level while I'm still on this earth." By revealing her imperfections rather than hiding them, she achieves this connection, demonstrating that our shared humanity lies not in our strengths, but in our vulnerabilities, not in our certainties, but in our questions. In the end, Broder doesn't offer neat solutions or transformative breakthroughs. Instead, she provides something more valuable, the comfort of knowing we're not alone in our messy, contradictory humanness. Her essays remind us that the path to peace isn't through transcending our humanity, but through embracing it fully. Contradictions, anxieties, fetishes, addictions, and all.